Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. A very happy Independence Day to you and all of yours. Thanks for joining us on this day of hot dogs and potato salad and maybe fireworks coming up a little later. This hour, we welcome Jimmy Akin, Senior Apologist here at Catholic Answers, for an internet open forum. We get lots of questions via the various internet media, and Jimmy collects them up for us, and then we answer them whenever we get a chance to do one of these internet open forums. Hello, Jimmy Akin. How are you?
Howdy, Cy Kellett. Happy 4th of July.
Happy 4th of July.
In advance, because we're not really here.
Oh, that's true. We're pre-recording this.
Yeah.
So we're probably eating hot dogs or something like that. You don't eat hot dogs, do you?
Sure, why not?
Oh, I don't know.
I just don't eat them often.
Oh, yeah.
Because the whole one meal a day thing.
Yeah, so at the very most, there's only 7 shots a week.
Yeah.
all right, we got lots of great questions. Do you feel ready to answer questions from the internet?
Mm-hmm.
All right, David asks, would the canonized saints be in agreement on doctrine or dogma with the doctors of the church?
Well, obviously, in heaven, they're going to have access to the source of all truth, God himself, in a very direct way. And so now they would. I assume, therefore, the question is, would they all have agreed regarding doctrine and dogma when they were still alive? And the answer is no. First of all, we should differentiate between doctrine and dogma because this subject comes up a lot. And basically anything the church authoritatively teaches is a doctrine. Different than theology. Theology, you can have different theological opinions, but if the church has authoritatively taught something, that makes it a doctrine. Within doctrines, there are some doctrines that have been infallibly defined. And within the set of doctrines that have been infallibly defined, there are some that the church has said are not only infallibly true, but also are divinely revealed. And that's what a dogma is. It's a doctrine that has been infallibly defined to be divinely revealed. And the thing is, though, doctrine and dogma develop over time. There were periods before even the Trinity had been infallibly defined, where people were still working out the language, that was needed to express the biblical truths that are expressed in the doctrine of the Trinity. How do we say this? Is this the right way to say this or not? And so people from before that time would have been considered orthodox even if they didn't use the language that was later hammered out. Mm-hmm. In the same way, you have church fathers like doctors of the church like St. Thomas Aquinas, who wrote before the Immaculate Conception of Mary was defined. And so in his day, it wasn't obligatory for Catholics to believe the Immaculate Conception. He wasn't fully on board with all aspects of it. And so the saints and the doctors of the church were orthodox for the times in which they lived, none of them were flat out heretics, but that doesn't mean they would have all agreed on every point of doctrine or dogma or theology for that matter when they were alive.
But they might have been making a good faith effort.
Otherwise, they wouldn't be saints.
Oh, yeah. I guess that is part of the definition of saints. You're trying anyways. David, thank you very, very much for that question. Again, it's an internet open forum for this 4th of July afternoon. Next question comes from Mark. Jimmy, can you elaborate on suicide and salvation and mental illness?
Yeah. So suicide is frequently committed because of mental illness. Not always. If someone commits suicide in their right mind, and knowingly and deliberately that this is a grave sin and they're just going to do it anyway, then that imperils their salvation. Now, that doesn't mean that they're automatically going to be lost, because God can reach people and people can repent even in the last moments of life, even in ways that we can't see or perceive. And so there's always hope, even when someone seems to have just kind of cold-bloodedly killed themselves.
Yeah.
There's always hope for their salvation. We can still pray for them. In many cases, though, suicide is brought on by some form of extreme distress, including mental illness. And so in that case, there's even more reason to hope for their salvation. There are two things. So God could always reach the person in the last moments of life and they could repent and accept his grace, you know, even in that circumstance. But there are also a couple of potential factors that could prevent the sin of suicide from being a mortal sin. Because in order for something to be a mortal sin, it has to have grave matter, and you have to do it with adequate knowledge of its moral character and with deliberate consent. Okay. And in the case of killing yourself, well, that is grave matter.
Yes.
But a person who's suffering from mental illness might be lacking either adequate knowledge of its moral character, like if they've had a psychotic break, for
yes.
example, or they may lack sufficient deliberation because of the mental pressure they're under that deprives them of full freedom and deliberation. One thing I would point out is even in the case of people who haven't had a psychotic break, where you just are, you're entertaining delusional beliefs about the world, there can be, under the pressures of mental illness, there can be situations where someone could lack adequate knowledge of its moral character. Now, one of the things you'll find if you read the Catechism is it's presumed that individuals instinctually know the basic laws of morality, mm-hmm. like don't kill yourself. That's an instinct that's built into all human beings.
Right.
But there can, due to the brokenness of human nature, there can be individuals who don't know that, mm-hmm. either just because they you know, something was wrong with them from the beginning, or under stress, they can enter a situation where they lose the knowledge of the moral character of the act, mm-hmm. even though they once had it. For example, humans have a whole bunch of built-in instincts that God put in us to help us survive and reproduce and things like that. One of our inbuilt instincts is death aversion, where we are averse to dying. We want to avoid death. And obviously that plays a big role in helping us stay alive. We naturally avoid death.
Right.
Also, we're pain averse. And so we try to avoid painful situations. But sometimes our instincts, because of the fallen nature of the world we're living in, sometimes our instincts that are meant to help us can be in conflict with each other because of the situation we're in. For example, another instinct that helps us stay alive is hunger. You know, when we get hungry, we need to refuel our bodies, and so we do, and that helps us stay alive. But you can imagine situations fairly easily where your hunger instinct and your pain avoidance instinct are in conflict. Like, let's say you're hungry and the only food available is a bunch of blackberries on a blackberry vine with thorns all over it.
Yeah.
And your pain aversion is going to want to make you hold back from picking the blackberries, but your hunger instinct is going to make you want to pick them.
Yeah.
And so you can see how those two survival instincts are in conflict in this case. Well, the same thing can happen with death aversion and with pain avoidance. Those two things can be put in collision with each other. You can be, for example, in so much physical pain that you're tempted to kill yourself.
Yeah.
To end the pain. That's
right.
The pain avoidance wanting to become dominant. Same thing can happen with mental pain. You're hurting so much inside mentally that you want to kill yourself to end the pain. And thus, once again, mental illness and the pain that involves can lead you to, it can kind of overcome your death aversion. And in that case, a person, even if they started out knowing that suicide is wrong, once they're in that much pain, whether it's physical or mental, they might say, is it really? They might start doubting that knowledge that they had.
Yeah, yeah.
And under sufficient mental pressure, they could innocently say, I've just got to end, you know, and through no fault of their own, they could end up in so much pain that they might decide to kill themselves. They shouldn't.
Yeah.
There are other ways of dealing with this, but they could lose the knowledge of its moral character through no fault of their own.
You know, that gives me a strong sense of this idea of physician-assisted suicide and all that that's being pushed actually could contribute to that sense of pressure and a misunderstanding of the moral character of the act of suicide.
Even though there's an instinctive understanding that you need to preserve your life, if you have your doctors telling you it's okay to off yourself, then that's going to...
Maybe even better for everybody.
That's bad catechesis. It has a distorting effect on conscience.
It is an internet open forum this hour. Our guest is Jimmy Akin, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers. We'll take a quick break and be back. We'll come back with some more questions from the internet after this.
Catholic Answers Live.
Homeschool Connections, an online provider of courses for your Catholic homeschool, is a sponsor of Catholic Answers Live. Homeschool Connections website is homeschoolconnections.com.
Catholic Answers Live is proudly supported by CatholicChemistry.com, a new dating site for Catholics who want to do dating right and believe relationships start with Catholic chemistry. Catholic Answers Live thanks CatholicChemistry.com for their generous support on the web at CatholicChemistry.com.
EWTN, teaching the truth.
I love listening to Catholic radio. It's perfect. It provides peace and it builds us up and strengthens us. We listen to it whenever we're in the car. My husband and I love it. He got me started with it before he even became a Catholic. He owns his own business and so he's working by himself and he listens to Catholic radio. He's called in several times too. It's using the technology that we have for good.
EWTN, live truth, live Catholic.
As he does, Jimmy Akin has a lot of new things out published, including two 20 Answers books, Protestantism, 20 Answers Protestantism, and 20 Answers the New Testament. And the latest big book is Teaching with Authority, How to Cut Through Doctrinal Confusion and Understand What the Church Really Says, all available at shop.catholic.com.
Yeah, so if you wanted, like earlier we talked about doctrine and dogma, if you want to find out more about that, get Teaching with Authority.
Yep. Up next, Don asks the following. The Catechism section 2241 and 2242 puts legal duties and requirements of immigrants entering the country. Why don't we hear about these duties instead of what we have to, and he puts this in quotes, give them?
Well, anytime you have a question that takes the form, why don't we hear more about X? Mm-hmm. The reason is because people don't want to talk more about X. The question then is, why don't they want to talk more about X?
Yeah.
And there are any number of reasons. So this is speculation. But I would say I can think of at least three reasons why we probably don't hear more about the responsibilities of immigrants under the law in this country. Mm-hmm. The first one is that there is a native human instinct towards self-interest. Mm-hmm. And when you have people immigrating from another place, there is very frequently conflict between the new immigrants and the people who are already there.
Right.
And the people who are already there perceive the new immigrants as a threat to their interest. And so one of the things that the church is called upon to do in many situations is fight against, by its preaching, the disordered self-interest that we all have as a result of the fall. And so there's kind of an err on the side of generosity principle that needs to be preached to counterbalance the inbuilt disordered self-interest that we have as a result of the fall. So the pastors of the church know we all have this inbuilt disorder,
right,
and it needs to be counterbalanced somehow.
Mm-hmm.
And that means emphasizing generosity rather than self-interest. And so that's one reason I think the pastors of the church tend to emphasize allowing immigrants in versus emphasizing their responsibilities under the law. A second reason applies to immigration in this country, which is a lot of the immigrants we have in this country are Catholic. they're coming from a Catholic background in their homelands. And as a result, a lot of the illegal immigrants. And the church does not want to alienate them because mm-hmm. their faith as Catholics is more important than political considerations. And so... You can just imagine if the church came out with a really strong legal immigration only stance really started preaching that would alienate a bunch of Catholics who've come into this country.
Right.
And they don't want that to happen. That's not their job as pastors to deal with the political side of it. It is their job as pastors to deal with the spiritual side of it.
Right.
And so they need to maintain that spiritual connection. I think that's a second reason why we don't hear more about the responsibilities of immigrants. A third reason is people join political parties. They have parties, they have sympathies for one party rather than another. And it's quite true here in this country that certain people in certain parties, and it's not just one party, there are people in both of the major American parties who are soft on illegal immigration for somewhat different reasons. But I think that the political sensibilities of many pastors in the church are with political parties and other political movements that are favorable to an open border policy.
Thanks very much, Don, for that question. Hope that was helpful to you. It's Independence Day, 4th of July, and we're delighted to have you with us, whether you're on the road or at home, wherever you are. We're just happy you're here. It's an Internet Open Forum. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Our guest this hour is Jimmy Akin. And the next question comes from Christy, and she asks, is there a special rite or blessing performed by a priest for a woman after a miscarriage? Miscarriage turns a womb into a tomb. Seems like there should be a blessing to heal that.
And there is. The Book of Blessings contains a blessing for a woman who suffered a miscarriage. So absolutely, anyone who has suffered a miscarriage can approach their priest and say, hey, I understand in the Book of Blessings there's a blessing for this. I'd like to receive it.
Christy, thank you very, very much for the Book of Blessings. There's blessings for all kinds of things in there. It's a large number of
situations. Yeah, this is a version of one of the church's liturgical books.
Okay.
So people will be familiar with like the lectionary mm-hmm. or the Roman Missal that contains the prayers the priest says at Mass. But there are other liturgical books that deal with other situations, including sacramental ones and including sacraments, and then in addition to sacraments, also sacramentals, which is what blessings are. So the Book of Blessings is a collection of different blessings that are used for different occasions, and one of them happens to be for this.
Again, Christy, thank you for that question. Next question comes from Clark, and Clark says, Jimmy, what would you say about the last couple verses of Revelation 11, and the first couple of verses in 12 as it relates to the old Ark of the Covenant and Mary, the new Ark? Plus, would this answer the question so many have about what happened to the Ark? To me, it seems to say it's in heaven.
Okay. So people, I assume, know what the Ark of the Covenant is. They've probably seen Indiana Jones and the Raiders of the Lost Ark. In case anybody doesn't, the Ark of the Covenant was a ritual object that was built under Moses and used in the tabernacle and later the temple in Jerusalem. And it vanished about the time of the Babylonian exile. And there are different accounts of what happened to it. At some point, I'm going to do an episode of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World on it, but haven't done that yet. Among the accounts are that Jeremiah, the prophet Jeremiah, took it and hid it in a cave. You find that account mentioned in 2 Maccabees, for example. There have also been claims it's hidden away elsewhere. There are claims that it was given to the Queen of Sheba, who took it back to Ethiopia after she visited Solomon. That one I don't think is plausible, although there is an object in Ethiopia that is widely believed to be the Ark.
Yes, right.
I think it's more likely a facsimile of the Ark than the original one. Also, it's been proposed the Babylonians just destroyed it. So what happened to the Ark is something of a mystery. And you could look at the last verse in Revelation 11 and say, well, this is telling us what happened to the Ark. Revelation 11:19, this is in the sequence of the blowing of the seven trumpets in Revelation, which announce God's judgment on the world. And after the seventh trumpet is blown, there's a celebration in heaven. The people in heaven are worshiping God. And then in verse 19, we read, then God's temple in heaven was opened, and the Ark of his covenant was seen within his temple. And there were flashes of lightning, voices, peals of thunder, an earthquake, and heavy hail. So it's a very dramatic event. And if you take it fully literally, it would suggest that the Ark has like been assumed into heaven and is in God's temple, because that's where John sees it. Mm-hmm. Having said that, Revelation kind of has a lot of symbols. And, yes. And so it's kind of known for that. And so there is a question of, should we take this fully literally or not? The Ark may symbolize something else. One of the things that the Ark represents is God's presence. In the Old Testament, it's often referred to as, it's sometimes referred to as his footstool or his seat. Mm-hmm. So like God is enthroned above the Ark. And so when John sees it, it could be a sign that God is present in his temple in heaven. And that's part of the meaning for this. It could also be a sign that the ultimate spiritual significance of the Ark is to be found in heaven. So don't worry about whatever happened on earth with it. That's another possibility. Then there is the idea that the Ark has a typological meaning. Typology is where something in one age symbolizes in a certain way something in another age. So, for example, Moses had a bronze serpent made, and Jesus compares himself to that bronze serpent in John's gospel. And so the serpent is sometimes said to be, the bronze serpent is said to be a type of Jesus, because when people look to it, they got healed of snake bite. Mm-hmm. So it's like a cure for the power of snakes. And Jesus, similarly, when people look to him, they get healed of sin, which is in another way, you know, like the power of the snake or the serpent. And so the serpent, the bronze serpent, was a type of Jesus, and Jesus is then the anti-type of the bronze serpent. So there's this type anti-type relationship. And when people have looked at the Ark, they have said, well, what may it symbolize typologically? Well, some people will look at it and notice, the Ark had the tables of the Ten Commandments in it, and it had Aaron's staff, which budded, and it had a pot of manna in it, which was the bread from heaven. And so who do we know that is a perfect representation of God's law, and who is who has priestly authority, and who is bread from heaven?
It sounds like Jesus.
Yeah. And so you'll have some people look at the Ark and say, guess what? The Ark is a type of Christ, like a lot of things in the Old Testament, mm-hmm. like the bronze serpent. And the Ark represents God's presence, and therefore Jesus represents God's presence. He's God with us, Emmanuel. Mm-hmm. So the Ark represents Jesus. But there's another interpretation, which is what I think our inquirer is asking about.
Right.
People will say, okay, well, the Ark contained these things that are clear symbols of Christ or can be taken as types of Christ. Did anybody contain Christ? Mm-hmm. Well, Mary did,
right,
when he was in her womb. So people will also look at the Ark of the Covenant and say it's a type of Mary. Mm-hmm. And they will even argue that based on some language that Luke uses in the beginning part of his gospel in his infancy narrative, they will say Luke is modeling language about Mary and her movements after some language that's used in the Old Testament about the ark and its movements. So they'll even say Luke seems to have an understanding of Mary as the new Ark of the Covenant.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I should point out, because symbols work on many levels,
yeah,
we shouldn't put these interpretations of the ark in opposition to each other. Just like the seven heads of the beast in Revelation are both seven mountains and seven kings, we're told, the ark can be a symbol, a type of both Jesus and Mary. So we shouldn't necessarily oppose those interpretations to each other. But it's very interesting then. Oh, we're going to have to finish after the break.
All right, we'll do that. Jimmy Akin is our guest. We're enjoying the 4th of July, so this is... We pre-recorded this, let's be honest. I hope you're enjoying the 4th of July. We got a bunch more questions from the internet because it's an internet open forum this hour. Jimmy will be answering questions that came to us through the various means the internet provides. More of that coming up.
In his new audio presentation, The Very First Fathers, apologist Jimmy Akin takes you on a tour of the earliest Christian writings outside the New Testament, from the most famous figures and most notable works to those lesser known but no less important. This pivotal time in the development of the early church is revealed in fascinating detail. Jimmy shows how, even in the first century after the resurrection, it was necessary to defend and explain truths that are still under attack today, such as the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist and the perpetual virginity of Mary. The Very First Fathers is a compelling look at the dawn of the Christian age and edifying listening for anyone who wants to understand and defend the full truth of Catholicism. Order your copy of The Very First Fathers today by calling 1-888-291-8000, logging on to the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Love and beauty. As a little girl, Dawn Eden Goldstein knew that she wanted those things, that in them somehow she would find God. Over the years as a rock journalist, she moved among some of popular music's best-known artists, straining to capture that transcendent love and beauty in every note and lyric. In Sunday Will Never Be the Same, Dawn recounts her spiritual journey in beautifully wrought detail, mixing powerful accounts of trauma, healing, and epiphany with funny anecdotes from inside the music scene. It is the rare conversion story that delights as it inspires, amuses as it edifies, and ultimately lays before the reader a lived testimony to the transforming grace of Christ. Order your copy of Sunday Will Never Be the Same by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Looking for an on-fire Catholic speaker for your event? Catholic Answers speakers will inform and inspire your audience to grow in their Catholic faith. For more information on booking a Catholic Answers speaker, visit CatholicAnswersSpeakers.com today.
Darren has reestablished groovy music.
Brought it back. That's awesome.
Sometimes it can be hard to get Nick to change. So are we going to be at, we're going to, when Nick comes back, we're still going to have, I like groovy music Thursday.
Yeah. We'll browbeat him until he consents.
That's a good point. Yeah. Browbeating people is a good way to get things done. Yeah. I have found it's very efficient. Jimmy Akin is our guest. It is Independence Day. Yeah. Is it written? Now, I've always... How are you with history? Because I think at the very earliest, people thought Independence Day was the 5th of July, because that was when the final signatures were put on the document, I think. But does this ring a bell to you?
I have not looked into this.
No? All right.
No.
Yeah, well, it's the 4th.
Before the break that interrupted us, just talking about the Ark of the Covenant and Mary and Revelation and all that stuff. So here's the interesting thing. So the chapter divisions in the Bible were not there in the original. And just like the break interrupted us in the middle of something,
yeah,
sometimes the chapter divisions in the Bible interrupt the biblical author in the middle of something. The only book that naturally has chapter divisions is Psalms.
Oh, yes,
because
right,
each of the Psalms is a separate hymn.
Right.
But all of the other chapter divisions were added later. They were added by a Catholic Archbishop of Canterbury in the 1200s named Stephen Langton.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where we got the chapter divisions. And so Langton plopped down a chapter division right after John sees the ark in God's temple in heaven. And then we read, and a great portent appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and on her head a crown of 12 stars. She was with child, and she cried out in the pangs of her birth in anguish for delivery. And it goes on to talk about how she gives birth to a male child who's clearly Jesus, and there's a conflict with a great dragon, which is the devil, and so forth. Now, because the chapter divisions are artificial and don't always correspond to what the biblical author intended us to see in the flow of the text, some people have said, hey, so we have reason to suppose Mary's the Ark of the New Covenant. This woman is described as giving birth to Jesus, so she's clearly Mary, and it's right after this mention of the Ark of the Covenant in heaven. So what's up with that? Well, I think there are several things that can be said. The first thing is that you have to try to establish the literal sense of the text first before you start looking at spiritual senses that the text may contain. And on the literal level, it is not clear to me that John is using the Ark of the Covenant as a symbol of Mary. He may be, but it's not clear that that's the case. Just the fact they get mentioned next to each other doesn't mean that in John's mind one is a symbol of the other.
Right.
I'm not denying that that's in the spiritual sense of the text. I think it is in the spiritual sense of the text. The question is, what's in John's mind in the literal sense of the text? Also, one reason that we need to be careful here is this woman doesn't just symbolize Mary. Mm-hmm. She does symbolize Mary. She gives birth to Jesus. But as we said, biblical symbols, including here in Revelation, can refer to more than one thing. Mm-hmm. And so it has frequently been pointed out, including by Pope Benedict XVI, that the symbolism here that's connected with the woman, she's clothed in the sun, she's got the moon under her feet, and she's got a crown of 12 stars on her head. That imagery is drawn from Joseph's dream in Genesis, where the sun and the moon represent his father, Israel, mm-hmm. and his mother, and the 12 stars represent his 12 brothers.
Okay, so and this is Israel too.
Yeah, so this is Israel as well. And there's a sense in which Israel as a nation brings forth the Messiah amidst great pain.
Yes.
You know?
Right.
And so this woman also represents Israel, and therefore that's another reason we have to be careful with simply saying, oh, it's the Ark of the Covenant, same thing, because the Ark of the Covenant is not Israel.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right.
Israel is not the new Ark of the Covenant,
right.
Not in any obvious, direct way. Mm-hmm. So I think we have to be careful with what we claim about the literal sense of the text here. But I do think within the spiritual sense of the text, we can see a connection here and say it's part of divine providence that Mary can represent the Ark of the Covenant typologically, and that we have the Ark of the Covenant here. And I would even say that within the spiritual sense of the text, this can represent the fact that Mary's assumed into heaven. Because Mary represents the Ark of the Covenant. John sees the Ark of the Covenant in the temple in heaven. Hence, Mary's in heaven. So I think you can see a reference here to the assumption of Mary, but it's within the spiritual sense of the text. I wouldn't go so far as to claim you can show that it's in the literal sense of the text.
All right. Clark, thanks very much for that. I looked it up. It was actually what I was thinking about. It wasn't July 5th. John Adams thought that Independence Day should be celebrated July 2nd. Because that was, I guess, the day they declared independence, and then they signed the document on the 4th.
Okay.
So the 4th got adopted. So that was what I was thinking of.
Okay.
Added a little backwards. Steve asks the following thing. I read that when the children at Fatima asked about a recently deceased person, Our Lady told them that she would be in purgatory until the end of the world. What's the average purgatory time? Anything biblical?
We don't know. Now, first thing, whenever you're evaluating something like this from a private revelation, you have to bear in mind a few things. One of them is that the seer, and this is right there in the guidelines that the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith uses to evaluate apparitions. One of them is that the seer may even unintentionally add something to the revelation.
Right.
And so you can't treat it like, oh, this is like inspired scripture. You know, it's yes. all accurate.
Right.
You can't do that. So you have to be cautious in that regard. Also, these are supernatural realities that are being explained to small children.
Yeah.
So they may be simplified mm-hmm. to help the children understand. And that's another reason why we shouldn't put too much weight on the details mm-hmm. of what's said in a context like this. Even assuming this is something that Sister Lucia didn't add on her own accidentally, and this is something that Mary said to her, it may have been a simplification, just meaning, oh, she's got a lot to deal with in purgatory, without literally implying yeah. it's going to take this amount of time.
Right.
In terms of time, the church doesn't claim to know how time works in the afterlife. If you look at medieval theologians like St. Thomas Aquinas, they have theological proposals about how time works in the afterlife, and they'll describe it as being different than either time as we experience it or eternity, absolute timelessness, as God experiences it. And they'll say it has some characteristics of time, but some characteristics of eternity, and they call it aveternity. Mm-hmm. And so it doesn't fully match up with our experience of time on that theological opinion, which, as we noted earlier, is not the same thing as church teaching. If you go with that view, we can't really say what's an average time in purgatory. We're also just not told that. It's possible for a person to experience all the purification they need in a single moment. And we know that's going to happen at the end of the world, because we're told that when Jesus comes back, we'll all be transformed in the twinkling of an eye. So instantaneously. If you look at recent discussion of this question, you want to look at Pope Benedict XVI's encyclical Spe Salvi on Christian hope. And in the section on purgatory, he talks about this, and he says that purgatory cannot be measured in worldly time as we experience it. It's more, in his mind, an existential event that occurs to us, but you can't really measure it on a clock or a calendar. And so so we really can't say what's the average time in purgatory. It may be time just as we experience it. It may be instantaneous. It may be something in between.
Okay, fair enough. Steve, thank you very, very much for that. You're listening to Catholic Answers Live, and it just occurs to me that there may be many of you who have not heard this program before, because it's a holiday and you're on the road or you have some other occasion to be listening to the radio. So if you want to know about us, you can visit catholic.com. And that's our website. You can find out all about Catholic Answers there at catholic.com. And we'd be delighted if you became a regular listener, either via the podcast, the show gets repeated in podcast, or we have other things there as well. But we're just happy to have you with us. We'll take a quick break. We'll be right back with more Internet Open Forum with Jimmy Akin.
Hello, this is Archbishop Salvatore Cordiglione of San Francisco. Keep your dial tuned to Catholic Answers Live.
Do you love praying for people? Have you ever wanted to use your gift of prayer to share Jesus with others and build up the body of Christ? Start a public prayer station with St. Paul Street Evangelization. Listen to people's needs, pray with them, or invite them to meet you at church. St. Paul Street Evangelization can help you get started. Find out how at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Catherine Zeltner.
There are so many misconceptions when it comes to abortion and assisted suicide. It's really confusing, and I think for a lot of people, they don't know how to talk about these things. EWTN Pro-Life Weekly, we help to change that. We help to really untangle these web of lies. Listeners can expect to become informed and then grow more confident so that they can then discuss and dialogue these issues, and together we can really impact culture in that way.
EWTN Pro-Life Weekly, Sunday morning at 10 a.m. on EWTN Radio.
Well, Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guest this hour, and we're taking all of our questions for the internet as we do on an internet open forum day. Next up, our question is from Dan. Dan asks, in Tobit, chapter 5, the Archangel Raphael says that he is an Israelite. He also says that he is kin to Tobit and Tobias, the son of Ananias. Is he lying?
So it's going to depend on your theory of lying, assuming you're using the term lying to refer to a sin as opposed to simply stating something that is not true. People state stuff that is not true all the time, and it doesn't of itself make it a lie. For example, Si, your hair is on fire.
What?
Yeah. Now, you know that as soon as I said it, that your hair is not on fire, that that's right. Not a true statement. So yes. It wasn't a lie because I wasn't actually trying to deceive you. Mm-hmm. So that's just an illustration of how not every false statement is a lie. It seems to me that, yeah, Raphael is saying something that, as the text presents it, is a false statement. He is claiming to be an Israelite and a member of the same family, descended from the same people as Tobit and Tobias, and that would imply he's a human being, among other things, and he's not. He's an angel. So it does seem he's uttering a falsehood. Does that make it a lie? Well, if he is in a situation where he has an obligation not to say a falsehood to them, then it would be a lie. But there are various theories of uttering falsehoods that would say this isn't necessarily a lie, because you can, for example, it is widely assumed in battle, before I go there, actually, let me tie up one other thing. You could say, well, but he could be mentally reserving this somehow. It's like, well, I'm an angel that's connected with Israel and your family, so yeah. I'm kind of, you know, no. He's saying something that if they accepted it face value, it's going to be false. Mm-hmm. So you can't just use mental reservation to get yourself out of any lie by attributing some unpredictable meaning to your words.
Oh, there's some stuff I told you earlier that I got to revise after the show.
Okay.
Then.
Okay. We'll talk later.
All right. Thanks.
In any event, so having closed that door, let's open another one. It's commonly assumed that there are situations in which uttering a falsehood, even knowing someone is likely to believe it, is permissible. For example, if Nazis come to your door and say, do you have Jews in your attic? You can tell them you don't. Mm-hmm. And that's morally defensible because you're saving a life and the Nazis don't have a right to know that and so forth. According to some theories of telling falsehoods, you could argue that, okay, Raphael is here. He's on a mission from God. It's important that they not realize exactly who he is yet, and it will ultimately be revealed to him. And so on a temporary basis, what he does is defensible. Mm-hmm. So you could try to defend it on those grounds. Now, I'm not saying I would defend it on those grounds, but one could. So that's why I say it really depends on your theory of lying, of exactly what is the sin of lying. Obviously, he's a holy angel, so he wouldn't literally commit the sin of lying. And that raises another question. To what extent is this account literal? One of the things you find when you read Tobit carefully is it contains stuff that sounds like clues to the audience that this text isn't meant to be fully literal, like Tobit's age. Tobit is described, Tobias, the father, is described as living, like, depending on how you calculate it, like 160 years or more. And this is not set in the patriarchal age. This is during mm-hmm. the Assyrian exile of the Northern Kingdom. So that could be a sign that this is not a fully literal account. Also, when the marriage occurs at the end of Tobit, a hikar comes. And to modern people, a hikar is not a familiar name. But a hikar was very famous in the ancient world. He was a legendary figure like Paul Bunyan. today. And so it's kind of like having Paul Bunyan or Sherlock Holmes show up at your wedding.
Yeah.
So that could be another sign that this isn't meant to be fully literal. And in fact, John Paul II, in one of his Wednesday audiences, said that this book, like a couple of others in the Old Testament, has a more allegorical, moral nature rather than being history properly so called. Mm-hmm. And so if what we have here is like an extended parable, even if it's based on some historical events like the Assyrian exile, if what we have here is essentially an extended parable, mm-hmm. then we're not meant to take this as an angel is literally telling people he's a human. Mm-hmm. That's not the lesson this is trying to teach. And so we need to back up and say, okay, what lessons is the book trying to teach versus what's detail added just to complete the story?
So that in a sense means listening to the author, not just the author literally said these things, but what signs is the author giving about how this
right.
text is
yeah,
to be interpreted?
It's like when Jesus says there was a father and he had two sons and this is what happened. The correct question to ask is not what were their names?
Right. Right. Yeah. But what's the point of this story? Why?
Okay. Yeah.
Fair enough. Thank you very much, Dan, for that question. Christy asks the following. Is there a Spanish version of Catholic Answers? The call-in show and the website is what she's referring to.
Well, Catholic Answers has experimented over the years with publishing things in Spanish, and we would love to have a Spanish version of the show and a Spanish version of the website, but thus far we haven't been able to attract the donor support we would need to make those things possible. So we do have some Spanish publications that you could find at shop.catholic.com, but we don't have a full Spanish presentation of the ministry. And if we'd love to, though, and someday if our donors make that possible, we would definitely love to do that.
All right. Thank you very, very much for that question, Christy. Let's see. Shan asks the following question. And begins it with an assessment. I have a strange question. We'll be the judge of that, Shan. When Jesus was born, Joseph protected him and they fled to Egypt. Why then, when Jesus was 12, did he respond to his worried parents that they should know he was about his father's business? He was only 12. I know that 12... was the age of confirmation for the adopted child. I'm curious.
I don't know what that's a reference to. This is something I'm not aware of.
All right. I'm curious to know how he went from a babe who needed protection to wondering why his parents were concerned about him at the ripe old age of 12. And they had an attitude of he can take it from here. I'm hoping I'm making sense. Yeah, I think you're making sense. Mm-hmm. What happened there?
So what happened is he grew up. As a baby, he naturally needed more protection, just like all babies do. But then as they grow up towards adulthood, they begin taking more and more responsibility, and their parents need to let them have more mm-hmm. and more responsibility. In this case, there's a bit of confusion because what Jesus's reply to his parents is a little ambiguous in Greek. What he actually says is like, why were you worried? Didn't you know I needed to be about the things of my father or something like that? And in the translation that Shan is quoting, it gets translated as I needed to be about the business of my father. In other translations like the Revised Standard Version, it's didn't you know I needed to be in the house of my father because mm-hmm. they find him in the temple.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like, come on, son of God, where am I going to be in Jerusalem?
Okay.
Yeah. and so they indeed, his parents did indeed, as good parents do, they don't try to micromanage every aspect of a child's life as the child grows up. They let the child have progressively more responsibility, assume he can take care of himself in a variety of different ways that he couldn't used to. And so by age 12, they didn't feel the need to keep tabs on him every single minute. They weren't, you know, helicopter parents hovering him over him every minute. And in this case, they made an assumption that turned out to be mistaken. They assumed that when they left Jerusalem with all the other folks who had come from Nazareth for the feast,
right.
that he was just in the party with everybody else.
Yeah.
And that turned out to be a mistaken assumption. And then Jesus, after they left him, he did what made sense. Let's go to the temple and talk to people about my father and stuff. And they can find me there. And they then didn't think to go there first.
All right, Shan. Thank you very much. They couldn't have been helicopter parents because Leonardo da Vinci hadn't invented the helicopter yet.
Yeah.
So
he does have some pretty helicopter-like things in his drawings.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Karen asks, this has to do with the possible change to the Our Father with regards to God leading us into temptation. Doesn't that also imply he is leading us to a trial of our own sanctification? Jesus was led to 40 days of fasting and prayer and ultimately towards Satan tempting him to renounce God, which, of course, he did not.
So a couple of things. The first one is there is no possible proposed change to the Lord's Prayer in English. The Lord's Prayer in Spanish for a long time has essentially said, don't let us fall into temptation.
Mm-hmm.
In France, a year or so ago, the French bishops made a similar change. And recently, the Italian bishops also made a change to effectively don't abandon us to temptation. The American bishops, the English-speaking bishops, and the German bishops have showed absolutely zero interest in doing this. And I'm quite confident they're not going to do this anytime soon within our lifetimes, because it would cause a bunch of problems. English, the Anglophone world where English is spoken, and also Germany, are quite divided religiously in the Christian community between Protestants and Catholics.
Mm-hmm.
And it would cause big problems to get our versions of the Lord's Prayer even more out of sync than they are now.
Are they out of sync now?
Yeah, because we Catholics will say, lead us not into temptation. Or I'm sorry, we'll say, forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us.
Yeah.
Protestants tend to use what's literally in the Greek in Matthew, which is forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors.
Oh, okay.
So they're already a little bit out of sync. And also Protestants tend to add the
For
thine is the kingdom and the power and the glory at the end. But they're already out of sync, and it would just cause headaches to get them even more out of sync. So I don't foresee this happening. But in terms of what it means, you know, Jesus did use a verb that is like lead.
Mm-hmm.
One of the ambiguities, though, in the Greek is the noun he uses doesn't just mean temptation. It can also mean testing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that actually sheds light on the situation with him and the devil when Jesus was, quote unquote, tempted in the wilderness. As the Son of God, Jesus really can't be tempted the way we are.
Yes.
He doesn't have disordered desires.
Yeah.
Now, the devil might be able to, like, put pressure on his ordered desires
mm-hmm.
to try to get him to do something he shouldn't. And that actually may be why the devil was doing this, because the devil's smart enough to know you can't get the Son of God to fall into sin.
Mm-hmm.
So presumably what the devil was trying to do is say, can I make him fall into sin? Because if I can, he's not the Son of God.
Mm-hmm.
And in that case, he wasn't precisely being tempted by the devil. He was being tested
mm-hmm.
by the devil. And so it's possible to translate the last line of the Lord's Prayer not as lead us not into temptation, but as lead us not into testing,
mm-hmm.
or don't subject us to the trial or something, or to the test or right. something like that. And so those are possible translations, and it does relate to Jesus's, it can be related to Jesus's tempting or testing in the wilderness. And there is a sense in which you can say, well, sometimes it is God's will, at least passively, to allow these things to happen. Whether it's his active will to do this testing is another question that's more of a theological matter that we don't have time to go into right now.
Thanks, Karen. Thanks for the question. Jimmy Akin is the podcaster, by the way. I think we mentioned this a little bit, behind Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World.
Oh, yeah. And since this is 4th of July, tomorrow, Friday, we have a new episode of Mysterious World coming out, and it's on the Roswell UFO crash.
Well, I was going to try to do some kind of sound effect there. That was a big fail. That was a big 4th of July fail.
Yeah.
Tomorrow, we have 2 hours of open forum, though, right? So people can call you. Call in if you have a question. If you've been like, hey, this is interesting, I'd like to call in with a question. Well, we're going to have the phone lines open for you for 2 hours. Whether you're Catholic or not, anybody can call with any question at all about the Catholic faith, Catholic people, the Bible, Catholic belief. We'll see you then, God willing, on Catholic Answers Live.